Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are looking at today, Tuesday, April 14, 2015. A member of the Presidential Guard and other military officers were killed in a shootout in Juba.
If there is no reason that was cited for their appointment, then there can be no reason cited for their dismissal. It's the same thing. The same authority that appoints is the same authority that, dismisses. And there's no question about that.
And President Kiir sacks his Minister of Interior and the caretaker governor of Northern Bahr al-Ghazal State.
If there is no reason that was cited for their appointment, then there can be no reason cited for their dismissal. It's the same thing. The same authority that appoints is the same authority that, dismisses. And there's no question about that.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Three people were killed yesterday when a gunfire erupted in a crowded residential area of Juba. Officials say the shooter was an SPLA soldier and that his targets were national security officers, including a member of the Presidential Guard. From Juba, Waki Simon Wudu reports.
Officials say the incident took place yesterday afternoon in the Haigem residential area. Police spokesman Colonel James Mande told a news conference that officials have no information about what sparked the incident. Investigations have been launched to determine if there was any relationship between the SPLA soldier and the two men he sought.
Very unfortunately, those, especially the assailant, what started the crime, he was also himself killed. He first shot two people. One was an officer from the National Security, but working in the office of the president. Another one is also a sergeant in the National Security also. He shot the two, and then so he was shot also. He died later on in the hospital.
Presidential spokesman Atieni Wek Atieni named the slain security officers as Akok Kwal Akwar, who worked in the office of the president, and Deng Kuch Dit, a member of the National Security Force. Atieni says he cannot reveal the name of the assailant for security reasons. Atieni says the two security officials died on the spot.
The member of the close protection unit of the president with his other colleagues from national security, who is a sergeant major, were on private missions and they were off duty when the attack actually took place. They were just driving. When they reached to a certain location, they parked their car. When they stepped down, they were just shot at close range, killing them instantly.
Police spokesman Mande says investigators are trying to determine whether alcohol may have fueled the violent incident. In a separate incident this morning, two Sudanese nationals were shot and killed as they slept outside in a suburb of Juba. Mande says three people armed with automatic weapons opened fire on the two men who were sleeping near the fence of a residence in Gudele. The men were shot at around 4 a.m., the police spokesman says. Both of them died instantly, Mande says.
The criminals managed to escape from the scene before the police could arrive. The CID and forensic experts have been dispatched to the scene, and the investigation and the search for the culprits are taking place.
Mande called on the public to help the police find the criminals who killed the two men. He pledged that they will be brought to justice.
South Sudan National Police Service appeals to the public to join in the fight against crimes by providing information about criminal activities in the neighborhoods.
Mande says the shootings are the latest in a series of violent crimes committed in or around Juba since the start of the year. He says police have new tracking strategies to find criminals, including hunting for vehicles and motorcycles without license plates and looking for vehicles with tinted windows. For VOA News, I am Waka Simon Wudu in Juba.
12 local and international human rights organizations are calling on South Sudan's president to ratify various African charters on human and people's rights. Elizabeth Deng is the Amnesty International researcher for South Sudan. She says the human rights record of the country is very poor and the Kiir administration is under international obligations to ratify the African charters on the rights of women, democracy, elections and governance.
The government has repeatedly said that it's ratified these treaties. Kiir last year in his speech to the UN General Assembly said the government had ratified treaties. And the Minister of Justice also said the same thing to the Human Rights Council. Unfortunately, this information was incorrect because the government has not, in fact, completed the process.
What happens when an African country ratifies some of these treaties? Let's look at the African Regional Human Rights Instruments. What happens if South Sudan ratifies this treaty?
Well, I mean, the benefits are numerous. First, South Sudan's constitution says that any human rights treaties will become an integral part of the Bill of Rights. So while the South Sudan's constitution guarantees a number of rights, these treaties would strengthen the protection of these rights and add to the number of rights that citizens have.
I know that on several occasions, human rights groups, including Amnesty International, have raised concerns that there is a culture of impunity in South Sudan. If they ratify these treaties, is that going to change anything?
Human rights treaties in general are often aspirational. And while, of course, it would be nice if ratification had an immediate impact on the human rights situation, we all know that that is not really the case. But they provide a point of hope for South Sudanese. They would provide, like I said, an additional option for recourse if the government is not making any progress. But ratification also allows for the monitoring body, the commissioners, to visit South Sudan, to engage with the government, and to help the government move towards respect for these human rights.
What is your assessment of human rights records in the country?
Well, I think it's not disputable that the human rights record of the government of South Sudan is very poor, and particularly in the context of this, you know, current conflict in which the government has committed violations of human rights and humanitarian law, including attacks on civilians, sexual violence, torture, issues such as arbitrary detention, detention without charge. These have been issues that, have been of concern in South Sudan for many years.
Is there any way that the international community could hold South Sudan accountable for these crimes, human rights violations that you are telling me? Because on several occasions, government officials, senior government officials have come on record saying South Sudan is a sovereign state and nobody should tell them what to do.
Although every government, every state in the world is sovereign, states agree to guarantee the people in their countries certain rights. Maybe perhaps you could call this a delegation of sovereignty, but you know, the idea is that this commitment is strong enough that a government is willing to have an outside body come and monitor and inspect and receive complaints from its people. So yes, I think these bodies could provide an additional course of redress for individuals. You know, individuals could bring complaints to the African Commission. They could bring complaints to the Committee on the Rights of Children, for example, regarding the issue of child soldiers. They could bring complaints before the Committee Against Torture, and they could send these bodies reports of concern. These bodies could, in turn, send members of the committees to visit South Sudan to ask the government for updates and information about violations.
That's Elizabeth Deng, Amnesty International researcher for South Sudan. She was speaking with me from Nairobi earlier today. South Sudan is the only member state of the African Union that is not party to the African Charter on Human Rights. President Salva Kiir has dismissed the country's interior minister, Aliu Yen Aliu, and a caretaker governor of northern Bahr Ghazal state. As Charlton Doki reports for VOA from Juba, the dismissal of the two officials has drawn mixed reactions.
Presidential spokesman Atenywek Ateny says the order was read on state television last night.
The presidential decree that was issued yesterday was for the relief of a minister of Interior and Wildlife Conservation. And another decree was the relief of the former caretaker governor of Northern Baragazali State, Mr. Kwela Gurkwela.
Ateny says the presidential decree did not give any reason for Aleu's dismissal, but maintained that Mr. Kir has the right to sack any minister.
If there is no reason that was cited for their appointment, then there can be no reasons cited for their dismissal. It's the same thing. The same authority that appoints is the same authority that, dismisses. And there's no question about that.
As for Quell's dismissal, Ateny says
the decree came as a response to the impeachment that was passed on him against his government back to February this year.
For several months now, tensions have been running high between the Northern Baragazal State Assembly and Quell, who was appointed caretaker governor of the state in April last year. Caretaker governors are supposed to remain in office for only 3 months before elections are held. Northern Baragazal state lawmakers voted to impeach Quell in January this year, accusing him of corruption, nepotism, abuse of power, and embezzlement. But Quell refused to step down. Last week, the leadership of the state assembly said it did not recognize Quell or his cabinet. SAD Institute policy analyst Zakaria Ding Akol says the actions of the state lawmakers have ratcheted up tensions in Northern Baragazal.
You recall he's alleged to have been impeached on the 26th of January by the assembly. And there was a tense situation at some point, which prompted the national government to send a committee to investigate what is going on. And I think the committee came back and gave its report to the president.
Akol says Quell is well-liked by some in Northern Baragazal. As caretaker governor, he oversaw extensive road repairs, that is, the movement of goods and people in the state. Akol says Aleu also notched up some notable achievements during his time as interior minister, even though he served as interior minister during a difficult time for South Sudan.
I took over the ministry in August 2013. It was a few months before the current conflict erupted in mid-December of the same year. Weeks after the violence erupted, the situation was tense in Juba, but it improved considerably. Now, of late, there are insecurity issues here and there, but those have not been to a level where we could say things have turned for the worse.
Meanwhile, Northern Baragazal officials had mixed reactions to Quell's dismissal. Veteran politician Ustaz Angelo Atak Akol faulted the former caretaker governor for spending too much time away from the state.
Already the effect has happened, and the absence of the governor in the state for almost for 3 months made a lot of things to shoot up. So there was a hope that if the governor or any caretaker governor was here, then he should be accountable. To me, the worst part of it is that one-party system without accountability is actually bad.
But Northern Baragazal Assembly Speaker Isaac Makau Ayok says President Kiir's decision to sack Quell was the right one.
It is very good news, and I'm very happy because this is a person impeached by the Assembly, and that is demanded and constitutional mandate of the Assembly, and he has been impeached due to the gross misconduct that has been not following the constitution of the state. We are happy and we appreciate the decision of the President, and that was our hope.
Another state lawmaker, Joseph Rolgao, is unhappy about Quell being fired. He says Quell had good plans to develop the state and provide services to the people.
He was working very well. He was insisting to make many developmental things in the state. The community of Awil were hoping that this governor will do good things in the state. But unfortunately, what had happened yesterday, it is something unhappy.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a new dike gets a go-ahead from Jonglo State officials. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what are you doing to prepare for the rainy season?
I work on my farm. We have a very big farm that I work on it. We go as early as 5. By 5:30, we start working and we come back around 3. We work, we plant yams, we plant cassava, we plant so many things, and we improve on the agriculture back in my place.
Well, I just buy clothes that maybe an umbrella or something that can help me when it's raining.
Okay, you know, I have come from my constituency on Sunday, and it was Easter, and I was in my constituency because it's agricultural time. I have to go and talk to people. We have to start cultivating, preparing even our land. So what I want to say for the people of Africa, this is the time we have to start cultivating to have food.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today, we are talking about the prevention of mother-to-child transmission. Mothers in western Bahr al-Ghazal state say while teaching hospitals, antenatal care service for pregnant mothers with HIV has become a beacon of hope for hundreds of HIV-positive mothers. As Dimo Silva reports for VOA from WOW, officials recently revealed that the center has been able to help save the lives of nearly 70 babies.
Since 2010, when the PMTCT program began, 68 babies born to HIV-positive mothers who participated in the WOW Teaching Hospital program have tested negative. In 2013, when the program's first report was released, only one baby tested positive out of 49 babies born to HIV-positive mothers. Today, Tuesday, the hospital reported that another 20 babies have tested negative, giving glimmers of hope to both mothers and their families. Officials believe this result points to a future where, with proper treatment, HIV-positive mothers in Western Bahr al-Ghazal have a relatively good chance of delivering HIV-negative infants. 49-year-old Rabha Alberto is one of the program's beneficiaries who gave birth to one of the 68 HIV-negative babies. She says the results helped her have faith that despite being HIV-positive, she does not have to pass that burden along to her innocent child.
When my child was tested negative, I was filled with a lot of joy. I went and told the people at home, and they all became happy, thanking me for having followed the PMTCT. All the worries before my child was tested have disappeared. I was so worried that she might become positive. I prayed to God to help my child to become negative. I am positive. The father is also positive, and so I prayed that my children be negative.
Natalina Wadrif, Western Bahr al-Ghazal State's HIV coordinator, says the WOW program proves that with proper resources and education, more babies of HIV-positive mothers will be spared.
After 2010, 2011, 2012, the achievement of our service is now appearing by the negative children from the positive mother. And those mothers, when they test their children after 18 months and the child got negative result, even we will celebrate. And even the mother with the family, they will be very happy and celebrate. And even the people living by themselves, they are the one spreading this information out that I'm able to live as anyone. I'm able to produce negative child.
Natalina says due to South Sudan's high illiteracy rate, combined with the fact that many people simply refuse to accept the realities of HIV/AIDS, it is an uphill battle to convince HIV-positive mothers to come in and get help. Natalina adds that for many husbands, it is the first time they are learning their wives are HIV-positive, which means they too may be carrying the virus.
Their husband are not coming with them. And that why is giving us challenge, because when you test the mother positive here, it's very hard to the mother to go and spread to share the information with the husband, because it will create the problem. Even it will create divorce. And also, this one will create a family issue, because our idea here, if someone tested positive first, they will think the tested positive first is the one bringing the disease at home.
Some HIV-positive mothers in the program conceal their status from their partners for fear of retribution. When delivering at Wau Teaching Hospital, they ask nurses and doctors not to reveal to their husbands that the baby is connected to the program for fear of divorce or domestic violence. Program supervisor Helen Pio says she was recently forced to provide treatment for an HIV-positive mother newborn baby in a different part of the hospital at the request of the mother, who does not want her baby, her husband, to know.
Yesterday, there is a mother who delivered here in the hospital. She is a positive mother, but the husband, she don't want the husband to know. Because if she say to the husband she is a positive, it will create a problem at home. So she delivered here, and the husband is there. But I asked her, do you inform your husband? She say, my sister, you keep quiet. When I go home, after 45 days, I will come to you so that we may discuss what is going to happen. And how can you help me to inform my husband? Because if now I say to my husband I am positive, it is very, very difficult. Then I take the baby from other place and go to other place and give the drugs for the baby. Then I return the baby.
Pio says some mothers who tested positive declined to take part in the program, referring instead to seek treatment at private health care facilities. She says they were worried about the stigma of being labeled HIV positive. Throughout Western Baal Ghazal, many people are afraid to be seen at voluntary counseling or testing centers. A 2005 survey says Western Baal Ghazal HIV rate stands at 1.3% of the population, the latest survey available on HIV rates in the state. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio, reporting in Wau.
From Wau, we move to Jonglo State. State ministers yesterday approved the expenditure of more than 400,000 South Sudanese pounds to refurbish a dike in Twitch East County that officials hope will reduce destruction caused by flooding on the River Nile. Officials also hope it will encourage farmers to plant more crops and provide more grazing land for cattle. Philip Tonaleu reports for VOA from Bor.
At a rare meeting chaired by caretaker governor John Kungnyuan, officials heard presentations from officials with the Jonglo State Ministry of Physical Infrastructure about the need to build a dike in Twitch East County. Minister of Information Judy Jonglo Boyeris says given the high priority of the project, officials move quickly.
The Council of Ministers today passed an amount of 420,000 South Sudanese pounds to save the life of people of Twitches, to dig the dike.
Boyeri says the state government will pan the 26-kilometer dike, a dike that will protect the administrative units and villages in Twitch East County.
And immediately, the Council of Ministers asked Honorable Minister of Finance to release this money in order to start the work as soon as possible.
Jonglo officials say flooding occur every year during the rainy season, affecting some 85,000 people, which is just about the entire population of the county, according to the latest census taken in 2008. Dao Akoi Jurkuch, the commissioner of Twitch East County, applauded the state government's quick action. He says efforts by humanitarian agencies to keep waters away from residential and farming areas have not stopped seasonal flooding. He says building a permanent dike will help local be more self-reliant.
First of all, the livelihood had been affected by the flood. That means the agriculture, they will be affected, and also the livestock also it will be affected by the flood. So that means the flood is affecting the food security. So if we put a dike, that means the life, they will be changed and they will be improved in the food security.
Jurkuch says the dike was first built in 2011, but the rising water levels in the River Nile continue to break through at more vulnerable points. He says that over the years, Flooding from the River Nile also contaminates water sources, resulting in waterborne diseases such as diarrhea and an increase in snake bites. The project will cover the cost of repairing broken sections of the previous dike and increase the height so that rising water levels of the Nile will not easily overflow. Officials declined to say when the construction will start or how long it will take to complete. South Korean peacekeepers recently started building a level to help prevent flooding near Yongle State's Panliet village. It is an extension of a dike that bypassed Panliet. That project may have been the impetus for South Sudanese officials to build the dike in Tuch East County. Now, with the onset of the rainy season, officials say it will be a race against time to avoid flooding this year and encourage more farming. For BOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Bor.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for today's bombing and assault of a government complex in the capital, Mogadishu. Security Ministry spokesman Mohammed Yusuf says 18 people were killed and at least 15 others wounded in the attack on the country's higher education ministry. A witness said militants set off a car bomb outside the ministry walls, allowing the attackers to storm the building and open fire. The United Nations Security Council has approved an arms embargo on the leaders of Yemen's Shiite Houthi rebels and demanded the group withdraw from the capital Sana'a and all other territory it has captured. The council voted 14-0 on a resolution today, with Russia abstaining. The measure, drafted by Jordan and Arab Gulf countries, would also impose a travel ban and an asset freeze on rebel leader Abdul Malik al-Houthi and Ahmed Ali Abdullah Saleh, the son of Yemen's former president who supports the Houthis. And finally, it has been 1 year since Boko Haram took 276 teenage schoolgirls from their dormitory in the northeastern Nigerian town of Chibok. The kidnapping struck a chord outside the northeast that 5 years of murderous insurgency there had not. The Bring Back Our Girls movement has held daily rallies in Nigeria since just after the girls were taken. School-aged girls today took part in a nationwide march as ambassadors for the Chibok girls. And that's a look at some of today's stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
And that's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Salah by Kebas featuring Trisha C.
Yeah. Kebas and Trisha C. And observing. Yeah. Let's pray. Yeah. Let's pray. Yeah, brother, you should never bother. Anything is possible, salam is possible. No, no more gunshots in the night. No, no more fights, only likes. I shan't kill a wallet sharp, K-Bass, massive mic. Fibidaya, I know young boy, good now, our vision. K-Blue, AKG, and my man, and the locals, he's fire. Now me and Trisha say, pray. Jake Terror, pray. My man Evans, pray.
We have been listening to Kebas featuring Trisha C with the song Salah. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could be here. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
You're a big, I'm 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 a big, I'